Hello there, you're listening to Radio Free Brighton. Now we have for you some coverage from the Food Sovereignty Next Steps, a World Family Calabash. This was a series of talks which went on the 20th of October at the Friends Meeting House in Brighton, an evening of talks, discussion and good food with Colin Tudge, Helen Yego, Sareth Fernando, Sue Dibb and Roberto Caballero. Enjoy.
Well, thank you for the invitation to speak, and thank you for coming. I hope you don't mind if I sit down, but I've got terrible knees, so I really hate standing up. I started life myself as a biologist, but I've been very, very involved in farming for something over 40 years, and I've had the opportunity to talk to farmers and to farming scientists and economists all over the world, so I've got a bit of an overview. And I'm absolutely staggered by the difference between what is now happening in the world, which on the whole is a disaster, and what could be happening. Because just a few very quick, boring statistics, we have a world population at the moment of about 7 billion, and of them about 1 billion are estimated to be chronically undernourished, while another 1 billion are overnourished and are in line for diabetes and heart disease and all those other horrible things. And 1 billion estimated live in urban slums, and it's getting worse. And it struck me the other day that about half the world's population now live in cities, which is 3.5 billion people, half of 7 billion. And if 1 billion live in slums, that means that one third, roughly, of all the people that live in cities live in slums, which isn't a great statistic. Nevertheless, the drive, the logical outcome of the policies of most of the world's governments is driving people towards continued urbanization, and that to a considerable extent is equated with progress. But we've got a third in slums already, and it's not going to get any better. And at the same time, our fellow creatures are suffering. Something like 50% of all our fellow creatures are conservatively estimated to be in imminent danger of extinction. It's the fastest mass extinction ever, and there have been some pretty spectacular mass extinctions in the past. And the things that we hear about, like the collapse of the economy and peak oil, which has somewhat gone off the radar recently, are actually quite small compared with the state of the general state of the world. That is what is actually happening. But, you know, one says to oneself, look, if we could only feed everybody in the world well, then, you know, most of our, in a sense, most, not all our problems disappear, but everything else we think we take seriously, like world peace and personal fulfillment and all those things, become possible. So the very basic thing you really have to do is to feed everybody well. And the question is that really possible? And the answer, when you start looking at agriculture seriously, as opposed to the way that governments look at it, and government scientists look at it, and all the rest, when you start looking at agriculture seriously, you find that it is very easy, actually, to feed 7 billion people well. And John Bennington, the chief government scientist, and lots of other people, recently produced a report at huge expense saying, well, by 2050 we'll have 9 billion people, and in order to feed them, since we don't feed the seven even now, we have to increase the amount of food we're producing by 50% at least within the next 30 years, and that's going to be incredibly difficult. And the only way we could do it is by GMOs and putting faith in people like me, i.e. Bennington. And that is complete nonsense, actually. And the United Nations say, you know, we're going to have 9 billion by 2050, certainly, but then the population should level out. So if you can feed 9 billion, you've solved the problem forever. And Hans Herren, who really does know something about agriculture, who's head of the IAA STD, and I don't know what it stands for, yeah. Actually. You know what it stands for. I've forgotten what it stands for, but it's you know, Hans is one of the people in the world who really does know about agriculture. He points out that we already produce in the world, in the way of food, 4,800 calories per head, which is enough, actually, to feed twice as many people as we now have. We're already producing enough calories to feed 14 billion people. So feeding 9 billion by 2050 shouldn't actually be hard. So why are these people saying we need another 50%, or even some people are saying we need twice as much as we do now? Actually, it's for commercial reasons, but I'll come to that later. I've only got another 5 minutes, I think, haven't I? Something like that. Anyway, the point is, how, in reality, do you feed 7 billion people or indeed 9 billion people? Well, it's obvious that you've got to get three things right. The first is you've got to be productive, you've got to be able to produce a lot, but enough's enough. We don't actually have to produce incredible amounts. We only have to produce enough for 7 or 9 billion people, and we're already doing that. So, you know, that's not the huge problem. The second thing is we have to be sustainable. And governments get the meaning of sustainable horribly wrong. You know, they've got this thing now, sustainable intensification. It's actually an oxymoron, but I haven't got time to discuss that either. But the word sustainable, they seem to think that it means stability, doing the same things in the future that you do now. Shouldn't mean that at all. What it should mean, as somebody put it the other day, is maintaining adaptability. In other words, maintaining the ability to change as time progresses. And you can translate that into farmer speak. It's a question, really, what we have to do is keep the soil in good heart, whatever we do, so that whatever we need to do in the future, we can do it. And the third thing we need, which is related to sustainability, of course, is resilience. In other words, whatever we're doing now, we need to be able to change direction in the future, because we know conditions are going to change, and climate change is real, and climate change is with us. The question then is, how do you manage to be productive, sustainable, and resilient? And the answer actually is that you emulate or imitate nature, which has been productive and resilient and sustainable for the last 3.8 billion years, which, thank you, is quite enough. And nature achieves its wonderful trick of productivity and sustainability, etc., 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 by, first of all, by being very, very diverse. Diversity is the name of the game. And with diversity, you get a wonderfully efficient use of resources, and you get synergies. You get the different crops, the different animals, or in the wild, different plants, different animals, working together. So diversity is the main thing. It's very low input, nature. Nature only uses really what's around. And it's very, very integrated. Everything feeds on everything else. So the question is, how do these things, integratedness and diversity and low input, translate into farming? And they translate in terms, diversity equals polyculture equals very, very mixed farming of genetically mixed creatures. Integrated means a properly run integrated farm of the kind you see all over the world. Reached its height in Britain, actually, probably in the 1950s and 60s, now replaced by monocultures and so on. But in a properly run farm, there's no waste. Everything feeds on everything else. And this, the whole business of low input translates in farming terms into organic. And if you ask the question, can we feed the world with organic farming alone? Well, calculations have been done, and the answer is yes, you can. But also, organic doesn't have to be the thing you absolutely have to do. You don't have to follow all the soil association rules. Organic becomes one's default position, i.e. what you do, unless there's a very good reason for doing something else. Now, if you have farms that are very diverse and very integrated and on the whole organic, they are going to be very complicated. And if they're complicated, they need to be labour intensive. You need very high levels of husbandry. And if you have farms that are complicated and labour intensive and organic and all those other things, there is no advantage in scale up at all. So you might as well keep them small and to medium sized. So the default position becomes that you need small to medium sized mixed organic farms that can feed the world. Now, the powers that be, government scientists, will tell you that can't feed the world. We need industrial systems. That is nonsense. The small, well-run farms, when they're properly supported, are at least as productive, in fact, more productive than the industrial kinds, and they're much more sustainable. And as Hans Herren again points out, 70% of the world's people rely upon these small, mixed, quasi-organic farms at the moment. So this industrial farming of the kind we now have now, which is supposed to represent the future, actually is a minority pursuit. It's called conventional, but it's actually a minority support. But that's where all the money's going, that's where all the research funds are going, and so on and so on and so on. I'll just say very quickly, address the question very, very quickly. I think I've only got a minute, haven't I now? Jocelyn's going to tell me. Countdown. 2 minutes. The question arises, why, given that it's obvious on biological grounds, and I would say on moral grounds, that we need small, mixed, integrated, etc. farms, very, very labour intensive. Why do governments and government scientists and government employed economists advocate and promote the complete opposite, using our money? Why do they promote systems that are as big as possible, that are as simple as possible, in other words, are monocultural, that are as high tech as possible, putting in as much in fertilizer and so on as possible, exercises actually in industrial chemistry? Why do they support that? And the answer is, actually the answer is, it sounds crude, childish, it sounds, but it, the answer is money. Money and power, centralization of power. That's what industrialization is all about, because the whole world at the moment is plugged in. It's not simply a matter of capitalism, which isn't necessarily the great evil, but it's plugged into this particular model of capitalism known as neoliberalism, known as the allegedly free market, where everybody is supposed to be in sort of all-out competition with everybody else. And the race is on, whatever business you're in, to make as much money as possible. And if you listen to secretaries of state in this country talking about the future of agriculture, they say farmers have got to be more productive in this country, we've got to produce more in this country, but then they add, but you've got to be more you've got to be competitive. In other words, we in Britain have got to produce more, but we've got to do it more cheaply than the Brazilians, who have sunshine and space, and we've got to do it more cheaply than the Kenyans, who also have, well, you have sunshine, I think you've got less and less space as time goes on. And they're being told the same thing. They've got to compete with us, and we have technology and money and big machines and all the rest of it. It's just a ludicrous, contrived battle between different kinds of farmers in different parts of the world. If you want to maximize your money that you get in the shortest time in a country like ours, then you have to go down the industrial route. You have to cut labour, because labour is the thing that costs the most money. You have to get the maximum possible yield, because as they said, it used to say in Tesco, pile them high and sell them cheap. It's not a question of producing enough food to feed the human species. It's a question of producing as much as you possibly can and then selling it for the highest possible price. And you've got to add value, which means that you've got to take your cereals, for example, which you would normally sell quite cheaply, which could feed the human race pretty well, and feed them to livestock, because that makes them more expensive and you make more money out of it. This is very dangerous, this is incredibly wasteful. It is, in fact, the cause of the world's food problems. And my final word is, if we're going to get out of this mess, then we, as it were, ordinary human beings, ordinary Joes, we have to do it ourselves. The governments are not going to do it, big industry isn't going to do it, they're using our taxpayers' money to do something entirely different. We have to do it ourselves. That's why my wife and I and some other people founded the Campaign for Real Farming, which is subtitled A People's Takeover of the World's Food Supply. And if you care to log on to the website, you'll see what it's all about. But in the end, as I said, we've got to do it ourselves. Thank you very much.
My name, as you have heard, I'm called Helen Chepkerich Yego. I come from Kenya. I'm a farmer. So my friend here has been talking about, we've got to do this because it is us doing it. I belong to that group of people who are growing food in Kenya. And I come from a farmers movement, which we started in 2002. Its name is Ngoma. Ngoma is the word in Kiswahili for a drum. But basically, the word Ngoma is an acronym for a Kiswahili word of Ngombe na Mahindi. Ngombe na Mahindi. And Ngombe is cattle, Mahindi is maize. So I belong to a farmers movement of maize and dairy farmers. We campaign for our rights to the government, especially favorable policies and market access, and especially in the market access, we campaign against free trade, which has caused a lot of problems into our business. Why maize and dairy? Maize and dairy, that is our staple food. We eat, 95% of the Kenyans eat maize meal, which we make into a flour, and make a duff that we eat every day. Come rain, come sunshine, we eat a duff made from maize, basically. And this maize came and replaced, maize was not a crop of Kenya. It was brought in during colonial days, and we discovered that it could make very nice flour, unlike our traditional cereals, which we were using sorghum and millet. We used to eat sorghum and millet making the same duff. But because maize, when you grow, you get in large quantities, as we have had with Green Revolution, produce volumes and volumes, we got hooked up into the maize flour. However, we still have our cereals, our traditional cereals, and that is what now we are promoting under food sovereignty, because we have realized that with maize, we are not going to survive for long, because even as you have heard, maize now is even being produced more for industrial production and for animal production, and unlike feeding the people. So that is why we started that campaign, so that we can be able to protect food. Dairy, we drink a lot of milk, either fresh or curdled. So it's still also our staple food. If you come to Kenya, you'll be given a maize flour, duff, and a glass of milk. And that is what we go with every day. And out of campaigning for favorable policies, for favorable market prices for our produce, we realize that is not enough. As small-scale farmers, we grow more than maize and keeping cattle. We grow a variety of foods in our farms. We grow pumpkins, beans, root crops, potatoes, sweet potatoes, cassava, and we grow cereals like the grains of sorghum, millet, and wheat. And all these are food crops that we produce every day, and numerous vegetables. Vegetables of root crop, or vegetables of the leafy, or vegetables of small grains. So we ask a question which we have been asking ourselves as small-scale farmers. Who feeds us anyway? Because we make the 70 to 80% of the population in Kenya who live in the rural areas and are farming our small plots. And surprisingly, it happens that we are the ones who are even feeding the populations who are living in towns. But we are doing it under very hardship conditions. Because of trade liberalization, there's a lot of import food into our country. Because the European Union have seen that they have a quote that there is a growing population of middle class in the developing countries. Therefore, we should target them with our processed foods. And unfortunately, you will find that our supermarkets in the towns are full of processed foods. And the young generation think that to be developed, you eat from the supermarket. And so now we're running a campaign as small-scale farmers to say, let us eat our own food. Because the food you're eating from the supermarket, you're not even sure whether it is safe for human consumption. Unfortunately, Kenya, we have 3/4 of the area as semi-arid and arid land. And we have very many people living in those areas. They don't have farms to farm. It is very dry. They are pastoralists. They lose their animals because of the erratic weather that we are experiencing due to climate change. And so there's a lot of relief food imported to our country. And I think even this year, you must have seen a lot of pictures running, showing people in the northern Kenya dying of hunger. And so we get a lot of relief food coming into our country. And this relief food, we are even told sometimes through World Food Program that it is even food that was grown in maybe North America for the horses, but because there are people dying in Africa, they divert it to come and feed our people. And yet, in the parts of Kenya, where I come from, the high potential areas, we have the capacity to produce enough food to feed our nation. We have food rotting in our stores, especially at this point in time when we are harvesting. But as you have heard, governments, The worst government we have known is our own country government, who do not want to uplift the standards of living for the farmers and even access the food from the farmers and take it to the areas that the food is not there. They would rather see that they import the food from wherever than to buy from us as farmers, because in that importation, they are the ones doing it through their cronies and what have you. So they are making a kill out of importation. We have protested about those imports because we have realized that there's GM foods coming into the country. And as a result, we have run campaigns with like-minded organizations supporting us to tell people, stop eating this food because you don't know what you are eating. And we are getting good response now because the media has been very, very helpful talking of running series on GMs, and people are beginning to be conscious. And now people living in the cities are coming back to us as farmers that we would rather buy food from you because we know you grow your own food. And how do we grow our own food? One of our principles in the Ngoma campaign is own seed, our own seed. We have programs to make sure that farmers keep their own seed, harvest their own seed, share the seed in whatever manner. And even now, the maize, because it is a popular product, we have partnered with an agricultural research institution who have developed our own local variety seeds. And now we have our own local variety seeds, which is not hybrid. When we grow it as the farmers, you can replant that seed again, and you can repeat it 2 to 3 times, and you can exchange among ourselves. So we are very, very keen about seed, because we do not want to see any contamination coming to our country. And we know that, 2 minutes, we know that we will be the victims if we get GM seeds coming to our country. Our diversity will be cleared and we will be in big trouble. So we are protecting ourselves through our own seed. I'm told it's only 2 minutes. I have a few slides for pictures showing the real life situation in the villages. In our country, you find that is just a farmer representative from my area, and that is millet. He was standing next to his millet. It was just beginning to flower. It may not be seen properly. This is in my farm where we were making silage for the cows. Just run them through, still silage covering. This is a farmer next door is clearing the trees so that he can have a place to plant crops as a crop rotation process. That is wheat in the large scale farm. This is a farmer who was taking a baler to bale. What we do is that we pull our tractors. Our tractors don't have batteries, so we put one on the hill, we push it, and then it can pull the other one to start. You can see that is what they're trying to do there. Maize harvesting by the women. Small plots. That is our maize, our own maize. That's a farmer's garden, kitchen garden. Goats and sheep. The sheep are sleeping, you can't see them. Yes. That's chicken. Cows. A combine harvest for that wheat that you saw. Our home. These are children keeping rabbits for food and also for sale in the community. We have the same group. This is an old lady who just brought some green maize. Maize is not dry, but she's drying it out there so that she can get it to grind. That's our own state. The same state, and that is a granary. As you see it like that, it's a granary for millet. The same homestead. This is the kind of roads that we have in our farms. Recently, when we had big rains, the whole road was flooded with water. A farmer taking hay after wheat harvesting to store for the dry season. Just a general homestead. Darkin. Some ladies. The same hay. Somebody. Yeah, too many pictures of the hay. Anyway. This is a primary school. One of our campaigns, we do it in schools. Because in schools now, they run feeding programs. And we talk about own food in our feeding programs. So that the farmers, ourselves as farmers, we contribute the food to the school, and like waiting for the government to bring us maize from wherever. So we have said we give our own food to the schools so that each child eats food from their own home. Primary school. Also, this is a day school, secondary school, which also runs a feeding program. This was it's a water project in one of the schools. Water drilling. Just continue. Pumpkins. We eat a lot of pumpkins. This is a small-scale farmer who feeds his own animals using Napier grass. Just continue. That is the Napier grass that he feeds to the animals. Now this is how the maize is cooked after it is ready for harvesting. This is a young man who makes almost like donuts in the village, and then he takes them round. People buy it for breakfast. That is how he's cutting them up. This is a gentleman who does repairs of motorbikes in the village. It's the combine going to harvest or whatever. This is how our road looks like. Just run those ones, they are the road. This is our shopping center. That's a video show. You find young men going in the evening. Yes, that is our transport system. This is how we get to town on that vehicle. Some sitting on top there. That's a tractor in the farm carrying people. Shopping center again. The shopping center by night. That's still our shopping center. The only place we have electricity in our village is in the shopping center. So at least we take our mobiles there to charge them, and they can be able to have some other services there, like welding. Yes. That's just another general homestead. Should be almost coming to an end. A chicken place, a store for the food. Water. This is a young boy drawing water from a well. You see him washing his clothes from the same water. That is grass touching. That's how we build these houses. Oops. Continue. Weeding. Somebody weeding his nature grass. Everyday life. Continue. I think just run them now. Harvesting maize. Washing dishes. Carrying water. Oops. That's a lady carrying her water to home. Oops. Going to the market to sell his wares. A garden. Maize. Wheat. In those days, yes. I think it's over. Yeah? Thank you very much.
I will talk briefly about Sri Lanka's experiences. Now, Sri Lanka is a country where nobody should go hungry. It's a country blessed with such natural resources. What are the natural resources that we have? We don't have iron, we don't have other minerals, we don't have oil. What do we have? We have enough sunlight in plenty throughout the year. We have some soil remaining in spite of the continuous erosion that has been caused by destructive forms of agriculture. Now that I am speaking in Britain, I must say this. The tremendous erosion that the one of the biggest environmental problems that Sri Lanka suffers is soil erosion. Now, soil erosion began to be very intense after the central hills were all cleared up to grow tea. The country, if you look at the terrain of the country, at the center of the country are the hills. And the hills were forests. We have had many thousands of years of agriculture. None of the rulers at that time thought of clearing the forests in the hill country, because they knew that that was the key place where ecology is retained. When there was forest, maximum rainfall is in the forest, in the hill country, and the forest slow down the rainfall, and soil is protected by forest. And the soil protects water, it absorbs more water, retains more water, and lets it down the plains through rivers and canals and so on. And people cultivated the plains, diverting that water into various reservoirs and canals and so on. That is how agriculture was done. Now, this was completely destroyed when the British thought that they could make profits out of growing tea, and the best area to grow tea was the hill country. Therefore, they cleared all the hill country. No more forests. So, I think I must say this, somebody will have to pay compensation for this. So if justice is to be achieved, pay compensation to Sri Lanka for the destruction that has been done, pay compensation to Africa for the destruction they have done, Latin America and all these countries. Tremendous destruction has been done. But in place of this, in the name of helping these countries to develop African agriculture and so on, they're going to intensify the destruction. More chemical inputs, more fertilizers, more pesticides, genetically modified seeds, hybrid seeds that extract soil fertility too aggressively, thereby depleting your soil, requiring that you replace this fertility depletion with fuel-based fertilizers. How long are we going to do this agriculture? Because fuel is something that is getting depleted. If you just imagine the future of agriculture, if it continues to be in this form, there is absolutely no future. The whole world will go hungry if you count on this kind of agriculture. Therefore, now what do we do and how did we learn this? Now, having worked with farmers for long years, we looked at what farmers were trying to do when they do their agriculture. When they don't have money to buy fertilizer, they have to work without using external fertilizers. When they don't have money to buy pesticides and weedicides, they have to try and manage to do this without those inputs. When they have no money to buy their food, they just walk around and collect the food that is available free of charge. I think this we learned, and we have done this very, very effectively in Sri Lanka, and we now, my own organization, Movement for Land and Agriculture Reform, works in about 600 villages by what we have learned from the farmers themselves. How do we do this? We have been fighting World Bank and World Bank's policies, World Bank's advice and dictates. I don't have time to go into details of this, but you know how destructive this structural adjustments program has been, how destructive that their methods of reducing poverty have been. In Sri Lanka, we have been asked by advice by the World Bank, and our rich people have very happily adopted it by trying to produce for exports. Then they said, we can't produce for export because we don't have capital. So invite foreign capital. They said foreign capital, if invited, will not come unless we have infrastructure. Therefore, build more infrastructure. Highways, airports, harbors, electricity, telecommunication. We borrowed lots of money and built all this. Still the investors didn't come. Now we are going to do much worse than this and accelerate that process even more intensely. I don't have time to describe into all this, but I will just give a few examples or just summarize what has resulted. When tsunami came in December 2004, tsunami came and it destroyed most of the beaches and coastal people. Many people died, about 40,000 died. They introduced the plan to rebuild the nation after tsunami. The first thing they did within days was to declare that nobody should live on the coastal line. Buffer zone, 200 meters on one side, 300 meters on the other side. But they said hotels can repair and rebuild, not fisher people. So they made use of tsunami to drive away the fisher people from the beaches and therefore from their right to the sea and the fisheries. So that's their land. That's what they tried to do. Then they said, okay, this tragic disaster has brought us the opportunity of becoming one of the most attractive tourist centers in the world. So tourism was the next introduction. They made use of plan, tourism master plan, that was formulated in 1984. They said, this is our rebuilding plan after tsunami. All the money that they were getting from various countries were to be used to rebuild tourism. 42 luxurious cities right around the beaches, big fishing harbors for industrial fishing, those were their plans, tourism rebuilding. Something that made the situation of the affected fisher people even worse than what tsunami did. So these are just a few examples. So now they are trying to do it much more, more airports, more express highways, more. Now they say that they are going to make Sri Lanka the miracle of Asia. All our leaders last 33 years have been saying similar things. The first president who introduced this plan, 1977, finish my time, or 2 minutes? 1 minute, okay. He said Singapore model. Some other person, finance minister, somebody said Hong Kong model. Chandrika Bandaranaike, the next president, said we will make Sri Lanka the hub of Asia. The opposition leader said Golden Gate to Asia. Now they say miracle of Asia. Same thing, same meaning. They want to modernize and make the country attractive to foreign investments, to accelerate plunder. So what do we want to do? What do we do? Do the complete opposite. Begin by saying, you can't do this, you have failed and failed and failed. I say not only in Sri Lanka but all over the world. Give up planning. We have to reject their right to plan. Then take this message across to the poorest people, the most discarded people, the people who are excluded. Susan George was once asked, "Do you have any hopes for the future?" She said, "Yes, because the present system does not include 2/3 of the world population. They are not needed, therefore they are expected to disappear." She said, "They will not disappear quietly. They will create a new world where they can survive." That's the message. So what do? In all these villages where we work, we say, if you don't have money to invest, or even if you have money to invest, don't invest any money in your agriculture. Allow nature to work. Allow maximum sunlight to come into your field. Have as many trees and as many diverse trees growing into different canopies so that you maximize the use of sunlight. Prevent soil erosion completely by ridges and mulching, and allow microbes to do the rest of the work. They work day and night, millions and billions, making the soil more and more fertile. Complete recycle. Whatever you take from nature, you have to give back to nature. Drying plants, leaves, branches, excreta, animal waste and all that. Then the microbial activity takes place. Pest damages allow insects to look after pest damages. Friendly insects will control unfriendly insects sufficiently. That is how agriculture has been done in history. It works even now. So therefore, do agriculture with no investment. If you don't have money to find your, buy your food, take your food free of charge. Allow nature to produce food free of charge. Sunlight doesn't seem to be real at the end of the month. Carbon dioxide absorbed into the plant will not send you a bill. Moisture taken from the soil will not do it. Insects controlling unfriendly insects will not charge you. Microbial activity doesn't charge you. Only thing that you have to do is tremendous job. And that is to restore and recover the ability of nature to regenerate itself. Therefore, regenerative agriculture is the right term to use. I would even prefer to talk about regenerative agriculture more than food sovereignty. Allow nature to take over. We have to remedy the distortion that we have done. All human beings, farmers, non-farmers, industrialists, everybody, have been destroying nature's ability to regenerate itself. That has to be created. Everybody has to do it. Therefore, the issue of landlessness can be solved by accepting the principle that people who are regenerating land have the right to possess and utilize land. People who regenerate nature have the right to have access to natural resources. To take over. Last point that I want to say, even will be a tremendous good news to the poor. They are going to save the results, they are going to save the rest of the world, including the rich. But one important thing is that this good news to the poor has to be real bad news to the rich. Unless you make it bad news to the rich, it doesn't work. Right? So resistance, beginning by saying, you can't do it, therefore withdraw. We don't allow you to kill human beings, we don't allow you to kill our soil, we don't allow you to kill our animals, we don't allow you to kill nature. Get away. Allow those who can do it to do it, and they will save themselves. So this is going to be, to a degree, bad news even to all of us. Or we have to be cautious. Because we can either decide to take that option and allow them to take over the entire task, or we can still adjust into the other system. Therefore, we have to be very cautious. We may not do the planning properly. Thank you very much.
I just feel really honoured to be on this platform. You know, I'm just so aware how far you guys have come, and, you know, just really powerful, inspiring presentations. You know, I've just come down the road, really. It isn't working.
No,
need to hold it like that?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, I was just saying, and I just how honoured I feel to be on this platform, and such great presentations, and I'm just aware how far that you've come to share your experiences and your lives and your campaigns with us. So I've just come from down the road. But there is a growing movement of people here in Brighton and Hove and the locality who do care about how their food is produced, where it comes from, and who want to create a more sustainable, fairer and healthier food systems. And we in this room are very much part of this movement. So I just wanted to this evening share with you some of the what's happening here in Brighton and Hove. We're a city. We don't have a lot of farming here, but we're a city with 260,000 residents and mouths to feed, and we're a growing city, which together with our location, we're snuck in between the sea and the South Downs, puts pressure on available land. We have a lot of people here who are interested in growing their own food, but actually getting access to that land is a problem here. And we've got a strategy for the city. It's called Spade to Spoon. It's currently being refreshed. We've had this since 2006. It's an action plan for Brighton and Hove. So one of the things that we want to see change are, you know, those people who can make a difference. You know, whether that's one of the things that we'd like to see is more of the public sector food procurement being healthier and sustainable. We'd like to see much more done about food waste, for example. So the strategy just covers everything, you know, and we're refreshing that, and that will help, I think, catalyse us within this city further towards our ambitions. One of the things that we do, if you want to help people change, we know that actually just giving them information isn't always terribly successful. You know, we all know the right thing to do, but it's much more difficult to actually do the right thing, isn't it? So one of the things that we do to help people plan and shop and eat in a healthy, more sustainable way is help people with basic skills and confidence in cooking from scratch. So we train people to become community cookery group leaders so they can deliver cookery skills to those people who maybe lack the skills or confidence. And we've got a new cookery skills project that works with people with learning disabilities. It's one of the things that we do. And we continue to work with Age Concern. We run a project, it's got a great name, it's called Old Spice. We teach older men to cook. And also we do work with the other end of the spectrum, with parents and reading their babies. We've got a great project called Sticky Fingers, and Simon, our worker there, he works with young people with special educational and emotional needs at Moorscombe Forest Garden and in 3 East Brighton primary schools. You know, and I've seen some of the feedback from some of the kids. You know, kids who are really excluded, not interested, disinterested in what they're doing. And, you know, the fantastic work of places like the Forest Garden and Sticky Fingers projects really does help transform young people's lives at such a crucial time. So a lot to do around, particularly with children and young people, to ensure that they've got the skills when they move into adulthood. We also do a lot of work with people to adopt healthier lifestyles, particularly to help them achieve a healthier weight, you know, and changes for the longer term. Last year we worked with over 1,000 adults and over 100 children. We deliver those sessions where people really need it, in the workplaces. There's a slide. God, this is working perfectly. That is the right slide. working with people in workplaces, Black and Ethnic Minority Ethnic Centre, and more traditional health centres and other venues like that. As I said, you know, childhood obesity is a real issue, and I think whilst the statistics are pretty shocking, actually we're really pleased that we have started to turn the corner here in Brighton Hove. And it's really important at a time of cutbacks in government funding that we try and ensure that we can keep this work going, and we'll be making sure that we can try and do that. One of the things that we're looking ahead, well, we don't have to look that far ahead, is the real impact that many people are facing now around food poverty. The statistics out just yesterday, I heard on the radio, you know, big increases in the cost of fuel, people having to pay a lot more for fuel poverty. But of course, the one thing, you know, after you've paid your rent, after you've paid your council tax, after you've paid your fuel bills, you know, the one thing that people often then cut back on is food. And you know, I heard on the radio yesterday people saying, well, actually, you know, we're not eating 3 meals a day, we just can't afford that anymore. And, you know, in an affluent country like here, I mean, it shouldn't happen anywhere in the world, but, you know, for that to happen here, that's a real problem. You know, the cost of food has increased over 6% in the last year. You know, we've got the highest unemployment in 17 years, so one of the priorities for us is really thinking how we can address issues of food poverty here in Brighton and Hove going forward. Now, one of our really big projects, Harvest, is about getting more people growing food in city, and that's a project that is being funded by the big lottery, and we're about halfway through the funding of that. We've got about another 18 months to go, and we've got something like 100 community food growing projects and initiatives in the city, which is just really incredible. It just shows what an interest there is, and how this has, you know, really sort of struck a chord. And it's great that so many people are sharing a passion for, oh yes, Fork and Biggit. That's one of the great projects in the city. And we're also supporting food growing in schools as well. And one of the things that we're doing with our partners in Harvest Project is trying to identify new land. We've actually got a real shortage of allotments in Brighton and Hove. It's a traditional way of where people want more land to grow food. They go to, we're way below the targets for how much land should be available. We only have about half the amount of land in allotments. So we're really trying to, that we should have, sorry, as a kind of a national goal there. So we're really trying to work with a whole range of organisations to see if we can find other land that can be used for growing, for example, on housing estates. Now I think the slides are going slower than I'm talking. So you'll see a housing estate in the next one. And we really want to raise the visibility. I'm sure many of you will have seen the demonstration garden in Preston Park. Now, it's really great. Someone said to me the other day, well, you're not going to grow that many carrots there, are you? But that's not the point. It's not about the amount of food that's grown there. It's about the effect that it has on showing people how you can do it and how easy it is, and to really inspire people. A lot of volunteers run that, as well as with Sarah, our growing officer. And, you know, I think it's a real inspiration, actually. We also manage a small grant scheme, and we give funding of up to £1,000 to community food projects, and that SEQUAL money is really, really important and helps a number of initiatives get off the ground there. The other big area that we've started to do work in is around food waste and reducing the amount of food waste. It's shocking, we all know the statistics, something like a third of food gets thrown away, half of which could be eaten. And you know, when Colin talks and about how easy it is to feed us all, we don't have to double food production. One of the most important things for us to tackle is the amount that we actually do waste. We come along to events. We can do things with your community events or even with supermarkets. So come and talk with us and Vera afterwards if you'd like us to bring our materials around food waste to any of your events. And, you know, not only does that help us reduce the amount of greenhouse gases, but it also saves us all significant amounts of money too. And composting is a really important element of that. We've got some great projects around community composting, which, you know, maybe doesn't sound terribly sexy when you talk about it like that, but it's a great way, particularly where people don't have room in their own gardens, to do that. And we've got a couple of projects in the North Lane in Beaufort Terrace in Hanover, which, you know, they're coming together to compost in communal spaces. Jocelyn's moved me on here. Obviously, in a city like Brighton and Hove, you know, we're never going to be able to produce all of our food within the city. But there's an awful lot more that we could get from the local area. And so one of the important things for us to try and understand is to build those connections with producers within Sussex and within the locality. And to work with local businesses to make those connections and to raise awareness and opportunities around those connections for getting more local food into the city. So, and one of the key areas that we'd like to do much more work on is we're next to the sea. You know, we've got fish. It's really important that that is sustainably caught, though. You know, we've all seen Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall, I'm sure, and have heard about sustainable fish campaigns. And we'd really like to see within Brighton Hove on the south coast here a greater awareness for residents and tourists alike of the availability of sustainable fish, what is sustainable, where can you get it, and there's some, you know, great places here on the seafront and elsewhere that are supporting that campaign. And we've got to think about, you know, the other kinds of dietary changes that are going to help people and help all of us live more sustainably. You know, one of those is around eating less meat, for example. You know, that's very controversial with some areas. Policymakers don't like it. But, you know, it's one of those issues that we're aware that we can help play a role in sharing that information and talking to people about all of that. And so communications is going to be really important for us. So I hope that gives you a bit of flavour of the work. You know, I'm really interested to think how within Brighton and Hove, within a city, you know, we can think, what's our role in this? You know, we've got national governments, we've heard about the World Trade Organization, you know, we're hearing about the inspiring work going in other places. You know, but it is us as people who can make a difference. You know, just to give you one example, we engaged our members in, just before the local elections, Ask Your Candidate, some of you may have got involved in that, and actually saying to politicians, these are the big questions around food that we're interested in and we'd like you to be interested in. You know, what's your party's views on this? You know, and that really helped galvanise a thinking amongst the politicians of our city. And now, you know, we've got the Green Party in leading in the council. You know, that's something we're taking forward with them. So, just a little bit, I hope for those of you who perhaps weren't so familiar with some of that work, that's helped you see some of the things. And, you know, if you're passionate and care about sustainability and the issues that we're talking here about tonight, you know, do get involved. There's masses of projects that could do with your involvement. So, thank you.
In a sense, I don't like capitalism at all, but it seems to me a very primitive form of capitalism, which some economists I've spoken to says isn't capitalism at all, it's just a precursor. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mind a certain amount of private ownership. I mean, you can own your own trousers and you can own your own whatever, you know, roof over your head. It doesn't have to be like you know, Proudhon, all property is theft. We don't have to go down that route. But on the other hand, you know, the other extreme of obscene wealth, gratuitous wealth, becomes evil and not acceptable. And free enterprise, why not, you know, personal freedom and so on. The kind of economy that does that is what Jefferson described as he saw America as a nation of small farmers. Now, a nation of small farmers acting as sort of small traders, interacting with each other, it's a kind of a capitalism, but the point is it could work perfectly well and be perfectly sustainable. And the kind of capitalism we had in this country, I think really until 1980, where even conservative governments took it for granted that it was the job of the government to restrain the market so that it operated in the best interest of the people, that, you know, that could be made to work. As long as you've got a proper moral framework, you can make it work. If you take away the moral framework, if you simply do what Thatcher did, which is to allow the morality itself to emerge from the market, then you're in deep trouble. And that's what we've got.
That's right.